this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The first headline across the top of the page: Quietly, Toll Scoops Up Carrie's Amberley. And on the left side of this article, there's a picture of a building. The caption reads, Toll Brothers now owns a piece of Amberley in Cary. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Cary. Luxury home builder Toll Brothers is taking a special interest these days in all things related to Amberley, the 1,100-acre residential community in northwest Cary that's been fighting developer financial problems the past 2 years. Toll Brothers and two private equity partners in August purchased a 40% stake in a $1.7 billion loan portfolio that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation took over as receiver for the failed AmTrust Bank of Cleveland, Ohio. At least two loans in the AmTrust portfolio were directed to Sandler at Amberley, LLC. The ownership entity for the massive Cary development, says Greg Hernandez, a spokesman for the FDIC. Through its Gibraltar Capital, an asset management subsidiary, Toll Brothers paid $29.1 million for a 20% interest in a joint venture with private equity partners Oak Tree Capital Management and Milestone Asset Opportunity Group to pick up in 80 real estate properties across 17 states that includes the Amberley Tract. The FDIC is retaining the 60% stake in the properties. Sandler at Amberley is a venture of L.M. Sandler & Sons of Virginia Beach, Virginia, a company that has defaulted on dozens of real estate loans and projects along the East Coast in the past 2 years, including the 12 Oaks Golf Course property in Holly Springs. When construction started at Amberley in 2005, it was slated to become the largest residential community ever built in the Triangle, a massive development with more than 5,000 residential lots for single-family homes, townhouses, and apartments. Hundreds of homes have since been built and sold, but the future of the remaining Sandler land, as well as its developer commitments to finish the roads, water lines, and sanitation infrastructure, is now in limbo. The town of Cary has halted issuing any new building permits for Amberley's Peninsula and Village Square neighborhoods after discovering that the bank and the developer had defaulted on their financial guarantees to complete the public infrastructure. Cary Town Engineer Tim Bailey says that the town's development ordinance permits developers to obtain final plot approval and sell lots if acceptable financial guarantees are provided to assure infrastructure completion. The Sandlers had provided 17 letters of credit worth $1.8 million from AmTrust Bank, all of which have been disaffirmed by the FDIC. In the meantime, the Cary Town Council was scheduled to vote September 30 on a temporary land development ordinance that would allow builders in the peninsula, including Royal Oaks Building Group, Garmin Homes, and First American Builders, to contribute to the cost of the remaining infrastructure and qualify for the building permits they need to continue construction. The town is not going to cover for the developer, Bailey says. The builders would prefer not to pay anything, of course, but they are happy that we at least are doing something. Rich Van Tassel, owner of Royal Oaks Building Group, still owns 12 lots in Amberley and is hopeful the town can reach a resolution. It's a mess, he says, but it's a mess because of the state of the economy right now. Neither of Toll Brothers' top executives in Raleigh, Tom Anhut and Bobby Schooley, returned calls for details about whether Toll Brothers would be taking over development duties at Amberley. In February, Toll Brothers purchased the Hassentree Golf Course community in North Raleigh out of foreclosure. And now we move down the front page. We come to an article that's in the center of the page, has a black border around it. Inside that border, the background is a green khaki color. At the very top, there's a headline in bold black lettering. Fewer foreign trips. Many colleges see less demand for study abroad programs. And underneath that, the article starts on the left side, and on the right side, there's a large picture of a group of girls sitting on stairs with their books open, reading their books. The caption reads, Students from Meredith College studying at Sanspacro, Italy, last semester. And this article was written by James Gallagher with a Dateline of Chapel Hill. Despite greater emphasis on gaining a global education, it appears fewer students are spending time studying abroad, another likely casualty of the down economy. At UNC Chapel Hill, the number of students studying abroad has fallen 15.9% over the past 2 years, from 1,307 in the 2007 to 2008 school year to 1,127 during the recently completed year. Bob Miles, Associate Dean for Study Abroad and International Exchanges, attributes the decline to the down economy, saying students and parents have less money to spend on the programs. Financial circumstances are critical factors leading students to decide whether they can afford to do this, he says. Straight exchange programs in which students go to an institution abroad while a foreign student comes to UNC come with no additional fees. The student pays tuition to UNC, and the cost of room, board, and books is generally comparable, though Miles says the cost of living often is less. But only about 10-12% of UNC students studying abroad participate in exchange programs. The remaining students participate in programs put on by UNC faculty and staff or by other institutions. Those programs, which normally occur during the summer, come with additional fees and costs on top of normal tuition. And it's those programs where participation is dropping. From 829 in 2007 to 2008 to 728 in 2009 to 2010. Summer programs cost anywhere from $3,000 to $6,000 per student. The changing value of the dollar compared to other currencies, notably the British pound and the euro, also can make such programs more expensive. Kevin Morrison, Associate Director of International Programs at Meredith College, says many programs will adjust their costs, which frequently is posted in dollars, to account for any potential changes in currency value. Morrison adds that unless they are participating in programs that charge in euros or pounds, students often don't track exchange rates and frequently don't take such fluctuations into account when making their decisions. Participation in Meredith study abroad programs has been relatively flat the past several years, with 162 students studying overseas in 2007 to 2008 and 163 in 2009 to 2010. At Duke University, the total number of students going abroad is growing, but the number doing so for credit is slipping, says Amanda Kelso, Associate Director for Study Abroad. Kelso did not have specific numbers. The university offers students the opportunity to go abroad for internships, community engagement programs, and research programs, and many are choosing to do that over a semester abroad. I think that with so many opportunities available to them, students are having to make choices. Studying abroad for a semester is a choice they may not be able to make, she says, adding that the economy could be playing a role, but that she doesn't really know. Duke students traditionally have opted to spend the first semester of their junior year abroad. The general rationale for that practice is that the basketball season does not really get going until the spring, and students want to be back in time for that. Kelso says that while basketball may play a role in the decision, there are several other factors, including friendships, rush for Greek life, and internship interviews that make an impact. At the Triangle's other state institution, student interest in international study has been growing. At NC State University, 1,194 students studied abroad during the recently completed school year, up from 1,022 in 2007 to 2008. The bulk of those students, between two-thirds and three-fourths, participate in programs put on by NCSU faculty, which come with additional costs over normal tuition, says Ingrid Schmidt, Associate Vice Provost for International Affairs and Director of Study Abroad. The concept of the junior year studying abroad, she says, is evolving with fewer students opting to follow that plan. Education is evolving, seeing more non-traditional students, more internships. The amount of flexibility they have in their schedules may not allow them to go abroad for a semester, she says. And now we move just to the right of that article. This next article runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, Capital Pulls Offering, Wants to Sell Privately. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker, with a Dateline of Raleigh. And within the article, there's a face picture of Grant Yarber. He's the a CEO who will be discussed in the article. Following the withdrawal of its public offering, Capital Bank will now look elsewhere to fill up its cash position. The $1.7 billion community lender, with 83% of its loan portfolio sunk in real estate, was attempting to sell 34.5 million shares to large institutional investors on the public market. The expected take in the $60 million range would have been used to shore up the bank's capital base and support new lending. Instead, Capital is expected to turn now to private equity groups to restock its coffers. CEO Grant Yarber declined comment on Capital strategy. The private offering may mean issuing more shares at a greater discount, the giving up of board seats, and perhaps even a more thorough change of control, says observers. It always becomes difficult when the public market isn't accepting a bank's paper, says UNC Charlotte finance professor Tony Plath. Almost anything they do now will involve change in control. Capital's trip to the fundraising market came after bank managers disclosed in a recent U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission filing that Capital would be receiving a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, from state and federal regulators. Essentially a form of probation, the MOU put the bank on notice to reduce its exposure to commercial real estate and to do a better job of spotting problem loans as they become a problem. Real estate lending, both residential and commercial, have long been a banker's bread and butter in the Triangle, but after nearly 2 years of downturn and dropping prices, both markets are under strain. And that's why, in documents leading up to its stock sale, Capital had listed major elements of its real estate portfolio as risk factors investors should be aware of before buying. For example, some 35% of the bank's portfolio, or $471 million, is committed to land acquisition and construction. Included are $91.7 million in residential construction loans, 83% of which are speculative, meaning the return cash flow depends on if the homes are built and sold. About 16% of loans, or $211 million, is in non-owner-occupied commercial real estate, considered a riskier form of lending because the property is harder to dispose of after foreclosure. In some 35 loan packages in both residential and commercial real estate deals, valued at $71 million, the bank has agreed to finance initial interest payments from the loan proceeds, a method of helping borrowers along until their projects were rolling. The downside, however, bank managers admitted, is that under such an arrangement, the financial condition of the project may not be apparent and development problems may not be addressed in a timely manner. Finally, Capital's non-performing real estate loans at $24.6 million as of December 31, 2009, had jumped by 128% to $56.2 million as of June 30. The June figure represents a 6.2% of all the bank's loans, giving Capital the 23rd highest such ratio among the 102 North Carolina banks, according to Charlotte-based Forum Capital, a real estate investment banking firm. The last time we saw numbers like this was back in the S&L crisis in the early 1990s, says Forum's Matthew Jones. The only difference this time is that real estate-related problems have gone on and on and on. Increased set-asides of cash to handle problem loans have cut the bank's bottom line. Share prices have fallen to the $1.68 range. That's putting a hurting on shareholders like Burlington's Maurice Corey, an 8% owner with 1.025 million shares, who has seen the value of his holdings plunge from $3.9 million as of December 31, 2009, to $1.8 million today. Attempts to reach him for a comment were not successful. At least one analyst, Carter Bundy of Stifel Nicolaus and Company, has given up coverage of the bank. I will let you speculate on the reason why, he says. Other analysts, including Mark Muth of Howes Barnes, says Capital was facing a long slog even if it had been able to complete its fundraiser on public markets. We believe Capital will remain in a challenged operating condition for the next several quarters, Muth says in a recent investor note. He does not own shares in the bank. Outside of turning to private equity groups for new funding, Capital has a dwindling list of other options, says Plath, including merger with another bank or passing the hat among existing board members. A final option, other analysts say, would be to shrink the franchise by selling off branches. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. The headline, Southwest buyout could open doors to new routes from RDU. And first, at the far left of this article, there's a picture of some Southwest planes in their docking spaces at the airport. The caption reads, Parked Southwest planes at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. And this article was written by Chris Basden with a Dateline of Morrisville. Most airline mergers are typically viewed as bad news for passengers. Conventional wisdom says that eliminating a competitor leads to flight cuts and higher fares. But Southwest Airlines' September 27 announcement that it will buy AirTran Airways for $1.4 billion did contain a glimmer of hope that the deal might actually help frequent flyers at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. In the company's written statement, Southwest Chairman and Chief Executive Officer Gary Kelly specifically noted that the acquisition would allow Southwest to expand into new markets like Atlanta and Reagan National in Washington, D.C. He also said that it would give the low-cost carrier the chance to expand in some key existing airports, including New York's LaGuardia, Boston's Logan, and BWI in Baltimore. Atlanta, Boston, Washington, D.C., and New York City are all among the top 10 markets served by RDU. Does the acquisition mean RDU might see additional service to some of those markets? It does open up possible opportunities for us, says RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin. AirTran currently offers 4 flights between RDU and Atlanta. Southwest provides 29 daily departures from RDU to 11 cities, including Baltimore. Otherwise, the cities mentioned by Kelly aren't served from RDU by either AirTran or Southwest, although other carriers do provide service between those cities and RDU. So what service additions could we see locally if and when the deal closes? I think Boston has a reasonable chance to happen, says Michael Morstein, a director at Washington, D.C.-based transportation consulting firm InterVista's Consulting Group. He also speculates that Southwest might increase the number of flights between RDU and Atlanta. He's not the only one who thinks the competitive temperature will rise in Atlanta. I think you're going to see a fare war and a frequency war between Atlanta-based Delta Airlines and Southwest in Atlanta, says Tony Maupin, who heads local travel agency Maupin Travel Incorporated. Morstein doubts that Southwest will add flights between RDU and Reagan National and LaGuardia because those two airports are slot-controlled, meaning that the Federal Aviation Administration controls the number of takeoffs and landings there. While it's less likely than additional Boston service, Morstein also speculates that Southwest eventually might provide more service between RDU and Chicago Midway and Houston as a result of the AirTran deal. Not everybody is bullish on the deal's local possibilities. While he thinks the RDU Atlanta route will stay in place, aviation consultant Barry Clark doubts that RDU will see much new service. In the short run, it's not much is going to happen at all, says Clark, who points out that it will take months for the carrier to even obtain regulatory approval for the transaction. Even after the deal closes, Southwest will want to take even more time to evaluate the merged operations before making any major route changes. It's a process that could take in the neighborhood of 2 years, and the route landscape might look a lot different. All sorts of competition issues could come into play by then, Clark says. A Southwest spokeswoman did not return calls seeking comment. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal, where we come to the biz column. The headline that starts it off, Soleil's Mundra lists his home for sale for $6.99 million. In the market for a 17,792-square-foot home in North Raleigh, with 7 bedrooms, 9 full baths, 4 half baths, a swimming pool, a handball court, a home theater, and a pool on 4.46 acres nestled up to a lake, Howard Perry and Walston has the listing for the mansion, which is off Creedmoor Road. The asking price, $6,990,000. The seller, Sanjay Mundra. You may remember Mundra as one of the partners in the Soleil Group, the company that proposed to build a 43-story multi-use building at Crabtree Valley, only to be knocked down by the mess in the credit markets. It's the second most expensive home in the Triangle, multiple listing services listings, behind the late Wendy Painter's manse at Northridge, a 15,000-square-footer, going for $8.9 million. But be forewarned, besides buying electricity and water for the Mundra house, you'll be paying $34,000 a year in property taxes, based on a county valuation of $5.6 million. But that's pocket change compared to the $85,870 tax bill on the North Ridge house, which is valued at $9.5 million for tax purposes. Hey, who is that guy hiding in the annual Forbes list of richest Americans? None other than Dennis Gillings, founder of Quintiles Transnational. With an estimated worth of $700 million, Gillings made a sub-list of multimillionaires the mag sees as the next crop of American billionaires. There are a couple of other familiar names in this group. Wilmington native Michael Jordan, who went on to play a little basketball at $500 million. His heirness was bested by movie producer James Cameron at $650 million. Also on the list is golfer Tiger Woods, though it's hard to imagine how much of his $700 million fortune Tiger's been able to hold on to given his recent, shall we say, unpleasantness. So we hear a lot of bragging about the success of the Durham Performing Arts Center, the DPAC, if you will, the city's convention center. Not so much, with good reason. The convention center is being subsidized by Durham city and county governments to the tune of about $1.2 million a year, according to a report in the Durham Herald Sun newspaper. Thus, a change in management of the building might be in store as the city and county look for ways to get more bookings. The building's currently managed by Shaner Hotels, which owns the adjoining Durham Marriott, but that agreement ends on December 31. Bids are being sought to bring in a new management company, or perhaps renew the contract with Shaner, if that company offers a convincing proposal to stay on board. Wasserman Media Group consulting chief Gary Stevenson, who is based in the Raleigh office, is leaving the firm, according to a report in Sports Business Journal, a sister publication. Stevenson is departing 3 years after he sold the OnSport consultancy that he founded to WMG. Senior Vice President Malcolm Turner, who was Stevenson's first employee at OnSport, will assume Stevenson's title as principal of YMG Consulting. Turner is based in New York City, and he plans on remaining in the Big Apple. "I sold the business because at some point in time, I wanted to make a transition," Stevenson told Sports Business Journal. "I felt like this was a good time, and I've been talking about this to WMG founder and CEO Casey Wasserman for some time. The agency business is not where I want to finish my career." While Stevenson's next move is a mystery, Biz hears speculation that he might be interested in helping to build a new football stadium in Los Angeles as part of an effort to lure an NFL team to the City of Angels. Looking back at the NC State-Cincinnati game, remember that part in the movie Bull Durham where veteran catcher Crash Davis teaches the rookie pitcher how to use cliches? Biz thought of that when listening to the media interview with NCSU quarterback Russell Wilson after the game. Wilson, who played minor league baseball over the summer, stayed on a very even keel after the Wolfpack's big win, which got the team off to a 3-0 start for the year. He repeatedly kept saying things like, "We have to keep working on it and keep getting better." And another popular refrain was something along the lines of, "Right now we're just trying to focus on only one play at a time." Biz came away impressed with both Wilson's play on the field and his deft handling of the media. Wonder who served as his Crash Davis. Editors of a London-based publication, Times Higher Education, think they have come out with a better system for ranking colleges. The publication ranks what editors consider the world's top 200 universities based on a variety of criteria, including teaching, research production, research citations, licensing income, and mix of international faculty and staff. Duke University came in 24th in the world, while UNC Chapel Hill came in at number 30. NC State did not make the top 200. Harvard was number one. The Wake Med Foundation has signed up documentary filmmaker Ken Burns as the keynote speaker at its annual Society of 1961 Appreciation Gala. Burns is best known for his documentaries, The Civil War and Baseball. Biz is generally a fan of Burns' work, but if his speech is anything like his films, attendees to the November 29 event should plan on being there a long time. Whew, it's a rough business being a caddy. During Biz's recent outing at the SAS Championship at Prestonwood Country Club in Cary, a sincere appreciation was developed for the job that professional golf caddies do. Biz served as a caddy for PGA Pro Ben Crenshaw for the first three holes of the SAS Pro-Am, and Crenshaw's real caddy, James Hall, took pleasure in showing Biz the ropes. At one point, while running back to Gentle Ben's bag to grab his putter, for which he was waiting patiently, out fell the towel that Ho had loaned out so Biz could wipe off clubs, golf balls, etc., to which Ho lightheartedly boomed, "Did you drop my towel? Did you just drop my towel?" "No, Mr. Caddy, sir, no." At the next tee box, Crenshaw stood, clubless. He looked over at Biz and smiled. Ho shouted in alert, "He needs a club. How about the 5-wood? Restaurateurs have to be happy with the conventioneers being attracted by the new Raleigh Convention Center. Here's a heads up of what's been booked in 2011. The Electric Power Research Institute will bring 800 attendees to the City of Oaks in July 2011 for its annual plug-in conference. Biz is told that Progress Energy played a role in convincing the institute to book its first ever East Coast meeting here. The fall member meeting of Internet 2 will be held at the Convention Center September 30 through October 7, 2011, bringing more than 700 folks. Many vacationers to the Sandhills area of our state and its grand collection of golf courses have stopped by the Aberdeen Cafe on North Sycamore Street in Aberdeen. It's been an institution for more than 40 years, but now it's closed. The cafe ceased operations on September 10 after it failed a county inspection that uncovered a break in the sewer line. Ben Otchin and Rose Otchin, current operators of the restaurant, say they'll probably mosey along to a different location because of the extent of the repairs that would be needed to get the building up to code. Now, this is a road trip. The Carolina Hurricanes plan to take about 60 members of the organization with them on their upcoming European trip, which includes a preseason game against SKA St. Petersburg in Russia and two regular season games against the Minnesota Wild in Helsinki, Finland. That number includes players, coaches, trainers, doctors, media relations officials, and other support staff, according to spokesman Mike Sundheim. General manager Jim Rutherford won't say how much the overseas jaunt is costing, but he says that the hosts are picking up the tab for the trip, not the NHL or the Hurricanes. "We're looking forward to it," says Rutherford. "It's a great experience for our organization and the people that are going over." Rutherford says that about 260 Hurricanes fans are paying their own way over to support the team. That's about 2 to 3 times the number of fans that the league has seen travel on previous trips like this. Biz wonders if Dancing Granny is one of them. Contributing to Biz were staffers Chris Basden, Frank Van Leeuwen, Cameron Snipes, James Gallagher, and Amanda Jones Hoyle. And now we return to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first article we come to has a headline, "In Chapel Hill, High-End Condos Sell Fast." And there's a picture on the right side of this article that runs horizontally across the top of page 3. The picture is of the outside of a large building, and the caption reads, "The East 54 Project is doing well in Orange County." This article was written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a dateline of Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill millionaires and Tar Heel supporters with money to spend are fueling an uptick in luxury condominium sales in Orange County. The sales of residential properties priced at $1 million or more have become more of a rarity as the housing market struggles to regain its footing. But three new condo projects built in the last year and a half in Chapel Hill are luring luxury buyers with Tar Heel ties from across the country. According to county deed records, the buyers of the four 1 million plus condo units sold so far this year are Fareed and Mizuk Rafi, owners of an Alabama company and parents of a UNC Chapel Hill men's tennis team player, UNC nephropathology professor Volker Nicolet, Idea Fund Partners principal David Rizzo, and Stallings Oil Company owner and former Washington Redskins football player Donald Stallings and his wife, Billy Stallings. Nicolet says he did not want the burden of maintaining a house and keeping up a garden. I want to travel, lock my door, and know that the concierge service will look after things. Personally, I do not like many lots in Chapel Hill, seem isolated and remote from life, Nicolet says. In the past year, 11 condo units priced at more than $750,000 have sold to buyers at three new condo properties, including the East 54 project, which opened in October on NC 54, the Green Bridge condo project, which opened in April in downtown Chapel Hill, and the Castalia at Meadowmount building, which opened in 2009. Part of the recent surge in sales has more to do with timing, since many of the buyers have been under contract for months and were waiting for construction to finish. But developers of Chapel Hill condo projects say they are still finding strong demand for their supply, considering the slowdown in the housing market over the past 2 years. Some people are local, where they have a house here and decide they want a condo because of the maintenance-free lifestyle, says Tony Hall, owner of the Tony Hall & Associates real estate firm in Chapel Hill. Others may be from out of town and want a place to stay when they are here. East 54 has so far sold 86 of its 126 residential units and has another 10 buyers waiting in the wings with units under contract, says Lee Perry, project manager for East West Partners, the developers of East 54. Many of the units are the primary residences of its owners, but several units were sold as second or third home options for when owners are in town for business or attending university functions. Perry says that two of East 54's condo owners had opted during the construction phase to buy two units and combine them into one, which is how the project's largest unit sold for $1.1 million. That will be the only one at that price point. Perry says the remaining units at East 54 are priced between the high $200,000 to mid $700,000. At Greenbridge, located at 400 West Rosemary Street and Chapel Hill's newest condominium project, units were built with some of the most high-efficient green design features in the Triangle, including low-flow water fixtures, LED lighting by Cree, solar thermal hot water heating, and living green rooftops. Greenbridge so far has sold 18 out of 97 units in the two buildings, including two units that sold for $1.3 million in July and September. Greenbridge still has four units priced at more than $850,000 that are listed through the Prudential York Simpson Underwood real estate firm. Neither officials with Greenbridge Development nor Prudential YSU return calls for more details about the project. Dr. Michael Rosenberg, an investor and developer of the Castalia at Meadowmount building on Barbie Chapel Road, says the condo buyers in his building, where he also resides, are a diverse group. Some are quiet, modest guys like me, he laughed. One buyer at Castalia, Rafi, whose son is a student at UNC Chapel Hill, took three units and combined them into one for $4 million. Another buyer took two units and combined them into one. Only one of Castalia's 10 units remains unsold. It is priced at $900,000. Rosenberg concedes that the curvy hilltop building he helped design is a little unusual, but I like things a little unusual, he says. Was he concerned whether there was demand for such a high-end product? I guess I'm too dumb to think of things like that, he says. A lot about Chapel Hill that is appealing is its upscaleness. That's one of the things I've always liked about Chapel Hill. Atlanta builder buys Briar Creek site for apartments. That's the headline on our next article. And this article was written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. A new Atlanta-based apartment builder has bought a 15-acre site in Raleigh's Briar Creek area that will be the company's first test in a real estate market suppressed by slow demand the past 2 years. The residential group of Atlanta paid $2.5 million for a bank-owned site on US 70 between the Walmart Supercenter and the Briar Creek Memorial Garden Cemetery. The Atlanta Group plans to build as many as 280 garden-style apartment units on the property. If the residential group's principals can secure the bank financing for the $32 million project, construction could start within 6 months, says Kurt Alexander, a co-founder and principal of the firm. Alexander and his partner, Trey Massey, are former executives of York Residential LLC in Atlanta, and each has more than 17 years of experience in the financing and development of multifamily properties. They, along with partner Pablo Diego, decided to start their own company, which launched February. The Briar Creek purchase is the new company's first acquisition. Raleigh is one of those markets that investors are still talking about, Alexander says. When we sit down to talk to our investors, it gets traction because Raleigh is a market where everyone is still interested in investing. Alexander says it may still be a while before other markets like Atlanta begin to see job growth and new real estate development opportunities. They lack the real job growth that Raleigh still exhibits. Job growth in the Triangle and continued improvement of the market's apartment vacancy rate also have attracted the attention of other apartment developers from around the southeast. At least three other sites zoned for multifamily residential projects in and around the Briar Creek development are under contract to regional development groups. Epoch Properties of Winter Park, Florida, has a contract to purchase nearly 18 acres between Aviation Parkway and Solona Street at Briar Creek. The company has filed site plans with the City of Raleigh for a 276-unit project called the Jameson at Briar Creek. Joe Dye, Executive Vice President at American Asset Corporation, the developer of Briar Creek, says a second apartment site near Aviation Parkway is under contract to a different buyer. He says he could not disclose the identity of the buyer, but that it, like Epic Properties, has built apartments in the Briar Creek area in the past. They've had good success here before, and they hope to do it again, Dye says. A fourth apartment site at the intersection of Briar Creek Parkway and the planned TW Alexander Drive extension also is under contract to an out-of-town buyer, says Jim Mullair, Senior Managing Director of the Cassidy Turley Commercial Real Estate Firm in Raleigh. Allaire and Justin Good have been marketing to developers the so-called 25-acre Serenity site, which was taken over by Compass Bank in December. Allaire says he has seen a noticeable uptick in interest in apartment sites the last couple of months. He is tracking at least 11 apartment sites around the Triangle region that are either under contract or have a letter of intent to purchase. Construction prices are coming down. Land prices are coming down. You can almost build for the same cost as buying a complex, he says. We're not seeing much in office or retail, but apartments are strong. For now, apartment developers don't have a lot of other competition from new construction. In July, 9 apartment properties with a total of 1,282 units were under construction in the Triangle, compared to 3,234 units that were under construction the year before, according to apartment market research firm Real Data of Charlotte. The market also absorbed 2,331 units in the first 6 months of 2011. Among the 19 metro areas tracked by Real Data in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, and Florida, the Triangle ranks as the healthiest based on its apartment occupancy levels, employment growth, development pipeline, and rent growth. The Triangle market's apartment vacancy rate in July was 8.7%, down from 10.4% the year prior. The average rental rate increased by 2.5% from the previous 6 months to $786 a month. Barry Bowling, Senior Vice President of the C.B. Richard Ellis Commercial Real Estate Firm in Raleigh, says he had 5 offers on the table for the Briar Creek property before the sale closed on September 23. We had never heard of the residential group, but we checked them out, and they were legit, Bowling says. They were the most aggressive, and they wanted to get a footprint in this market. In our next article, inside the Triangle Business Journal, still on page 3, this article is in the center of the page, has a black border around it. Inside that border at the top, there's a large picture of the outside of Raleigh's Memorial Auditorium. Actually, the caption reads, Raleigh's Memorial Auditorium is less busy this year, partly because of competition from Durham. Then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, Show goes on, business slow at most entertainment venues. And then under that is the article. And this one's written by Chris Basden with a Dateline of Raleigh. The economic downturn hasn't been a showstopper for Raleigh's top entertainment venues, but it certainly has slowed business at the box office. The Progress Energy Center for the Performing Arts, the Time Warner Cable Music Pavilion at Walnut Creek, and the RBC Center all have endured significant drops in revenue over the past year or so. Local entertainment industry insiders chalk up the declines to an uncertain economy, as well as increased competition for discretionary income, particularly from the relatively new Durham Performing Arts Center. Crowds are not only smaller, but the people who are attending events are spending less by purchasing cheaper tickets and making fewer trips to the concession stands. The economy is still beating us up, says Dave Olson, the general manager of the RBC Center. Financials provided by Gale Force Holdings to the Centennial Authority show that the building has been hit by a revenue double whammy, with Carolina Hurricanes games and non-hockey events suffering. The Centennial Authority is the RBC Center's landlord. For the 9 months ended March 31, 2010, the latest information available, Gale Force Sports and Entertainment LLC's total revenue clocked in at $16.7 million. That was down by 8.7% from a year ago. The two biggest chunks of that revenue came from arena rentals, $5.2 million, and food and beverage sales, $6.3 million, for non-hockey events. Over on the hockey side, revenue also declined significantly. One prominent example, Canes admissions during that period totaled $21.8 million, a 9.5% decrease from the same period last season. The RBC Center isn't alone in feeling the pain. The Progress Energy Center, which includes events at Memorial Auditorium, saw total revenue decline by 21% from $8.5 million in fiscal 2008-2009 down to $6.7 million in fiscal 2009-2010, according to financial information provided by the City of Raleigh. Roger Kruppa, the city official who oversees management of the center, says the economy is part of the problem, but so is new competition. The DPAC, which opened in the Bull City in late 2008, now has the inside track on big-time shows like Wicked, thanks to the Broadway connections of its management company and the venue's larger size. According to preliminary statistics provided by the City of Durham, DPAC generated $20.3 million in revenue for the fiscal year ended June 30, 2010. While DPAC's lineup has a buzz about it, the Progress Energy Center is booking about a quarter fewer events this year. We're really struggling, Kruppa says. Every show is its own challenge. Still, Kruppa thinks he's got some good ones lined up for the future, including comedian David Sedaris, rock group The National, and unlikely instrument orchestra Pandemonium. It's not like we're sitting empty over here, Kruppa says. Walnut Creek also has been feeling the pinch. While the final numbers aren't yet in for this concert season, the venue recorded $18.3 million in gross revenue in calendar year 2009. That was a 23% decline from the $23.7 million it posted in 2008. Despite the plunge, Raleigh City Manager Russell Allen is still bullish on the large amphitheater, which is run by Live Nation. It's a great facility, he says. I think it will continue to be a good, strong performing venue for us. Duke expands genetics research. This article was written by James Gallagher with the Dateline of Durham. Duke University is looking to capitalize on its extensive research into genomics by offering to provide genetic analysis in clinical trials. The Discovery Genomics Program at the Duke Clinical Research Institute, Duke's clinical research organization, will offer pharmaceutical companies the opportunity to study the genetic composition of clinical trial participants. That information could tell companies whether a drug will work better in some people and not others, or whether certain individuals are more prone to incurring side effects. DCRI is among the first, if not the first, to develop a program for analyzing the genetic sequences of clinical trial patients. It is now possible to screen a genome for variations that have strong influences on therapeutic responses and susceptibility to adverse events, says David Goldstein, director of Discovery Genomics. An adverse event that severe can make it difficult to win approval, we can use genetics to see if a pattern can be found. The decision by DCRI to offer the new service comes after work done by Goldstein and his colleagues at the Duke Center for Human Genome. Genome variation identified how genetic variations affected the treatment of hepatitis C patients. The course of treatment for the viral infection typically consists of 48 weeks worth of drugs, interferon and antiviral ribavirin. The treatment only works in about half of the patients and can cause severe complications, including anemia. Many patients drop out before completing the treatment regimen. Goldstein and his team, working with Shering Plough, which helped fund the study, analyzed the blood samples from clinical trial participants taking the drug and found genetic variations within patients who benefited from the treatment and within patients who suffered from side effects. Using that information, LabCorp developed a test for the genetic variation to help hepatitis C patients determine whether they are likely to benefit from the drug or are likely to incur side effects, helping them decide whether they want to undergo the treatment. Dr. Bob Harrington, director of DCRI, says such revelations are particularly exciting for physicians who are now better able to steer patients to the best treatment options. Dr. Kevin Schulman, associate director of DCRI, says this is the foundation needed for personalized medicine to come to fruition. Personalized medicine is a concept in which a patient's genetic information is used to identify the best courses of treatment, as well as to identify diseases the patient is more predisposed toward and to work toward preventing those diseases. Jeff Banks, president and founder of ClinPharm Consulting, says there has been a lot of talk about personalized medicine, but the idea has not been readily implemented due to cost and complication. "I think it's good that Duke is doing this," he says. "I think there is a need in the industry to start moving in this direction and to have these services available." The genetic analysis work is benefiting from the quickly dropping cost for gene sequencing and analysis. A genome-wide association study to determine which patients are more likely to benefit from a treatment would take about 2 to 3 months to complete and cost about $500,000, while a study to determine which patients are more likely to suffer side effects takes about 3 to 5 months to complete and costs between $125,000 and $750,000. Such studies could, however, end up reducing the market for particular drugs by identifying the subset that most benefits. But, says Tom Kaminsky in business development at DCRI, such studies could salvage a drug that has failed a critical trial by identifying appropriate patients or by helping pharmaceutical companies find other uses for their drugs. DCRI staff currently are looking back into some clinical trials for failed drugs to see if trial participant genetics played a role and if there are any drugs that can be salvaged. So far, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has not weighed in on genetic analysis of clinical trial participants, though Goldstein says that based on conversations he has had with the regulatory body, he believes the agency could look to use it to assure patient safety. And our next article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Atlanta Startup Plans Local Operation, Readies to Hire 15. A startup whose business model is based on outsourcing complex accounting and legal work to India is looking for triangle space to set up a quality review office. Crown Bridge Group, at build-out, expects to employ roughly 15 lawyers and accountants in the office. They'll review the work product returning to the U.S. from the firm's 40-person workforce in Hyderabad, India, says Crown Bridge founder Michael H. Burton. "We will grow to 15 in the beginning," says Burton, "but it could get bigger than that over time." Burton, a UNC Chapel Hill graduate, is a former Raleigh office Deloitte and Touche tax practice executive who moved on to Boston and to other locations with the accounting giant before arriving in Atlanta, where the entrepreneurial notion of Crown Bridge was developed. Partnering in the venture is Triangle-based Pete Tannenbaum, a non-practicing attorney and one-time boutique investment banker who has been a freelance consultant and investor for the past 5 years. He signed on with Crown Bridge about 6 months ago as marketing and business development director and, as of the week of September 27, was out recruiting clients and declined an interview request. Let us talk when we get through that, he responded. When it became obvious the startup needed a U.S.-based quality assurance office to review the work product coming out of India, Burton says his thoughts returned to the triangle. Not only were the firm's key clients, partners, and investors located there, but I like it there as well, says Burton, who still lives in Georgia but will relocate. His Atlanta house is on the market. Crown Bridge clients are in the financial services area, but Burton declines to reveal their identities. He did say, however, that one Triangle client uses the outsourcing company to prepare merger and acquisition documents related to Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation-assisted bank takeovers. The company's India-based employees are all Indian law school graduates who go through additional training in U.S. legal and corporate practices. An increased workload has already prompted plans for what Burton calls an aggressive Hyderabad workforce expansion. Outsourcing companies attract clients by offering them a savings. And for the complex legal and tax work that will become the mainstay of Crown Bridge, Burton says that cost savings percentage can be up to 60%. That's the whole idea behind the company, he says. Companies like Crown Bridge also mark a turning point of sorts in the outsourcing story to India, whose shops once confined themselves to back-office customer support tasks, software customization, and related matters. The preparation of tax and corporate legal documents is something else again. Alok Agarwal, founder of Saratoga, California-based ValueServe Incorporated, and the man who coined the phrase knowledge process outsourcing to cover the categories in which companies like Crown Bridge are engaged, says the trend has been slowed somewhat in the wake of the financial crisis and recession. Even so, he says in an interview, the value of KPO transactions are expected to hit $17 billion by 2010, with $12 billion of that representing outsourcing to India. After the slowdown, we believe we will see those numbers achieved by the end of 2010, Agarwal says. 2 years later, RRC still waits for a buyer to close deal. This article is written by Chris Basden with the Dateline of Raleigh. And mixed in with this article, there's a picture of some tennis courts. The caption reads, Tennis Courts at Raleigh Racquet Club. 2 years after reaching an agreement to sell 5 acres of well-located land to real estate company Drucker & Falk, the Raleigh Racquet Club is still waiting for the deal to close, and the clock is ticking on the arrangement. RRC and Drucker & Falk announced the deal for land just off Falls of Neuse Road in August 2008, saying that Virginia-based DNF planned to build a senior living facility there. Proceeds from the sale would be used to help RRC, a tennis club founded in 1968, shore up its finances and add amenities. After the sale, RRC would still own about 31 acres in the area. David Falk Jr., a managing director for Virginia-based DNF, confirms that his company is still interested in the property. We're trying the best we can, he said, though he declined to say any more about the potential deal. The 4.89-acre tract is listed on commercial real estate firm Cassidy Turley's website for $1.75 million. According to the listing, the property includes 230 feet of road frontage and was recently rezoned and approved for a four-story, 129-unit senior living development. Cassidy Turley broker Brian Carr confirmed that the property is still under contract, but he declined to say anything else. So, just what's going on? RRC General Manager Mark Blauen says that the project will cost DNF about $12 million, but that the company hasn't yet been able to find financing due to the aftershocks of the economic downturn. He adds that the contract between RRC and DNF will expire October 15. They want it, Blauen says. Unfortunately, there's a struggle in finding a lender. Blauen is still hopeful that the deal can be closed. He says that DNF recently began discussions with a bank in Arkansas regarding financing for the project. DNF has put down about $125,000 in earnest money as part of the deal, Blauen says. The land sale is a key part of RRC's plans for the future. The club wants to use some of the money it would generate from a sale to fund construction of new kids' tennis courts, a larger pool, and a pool house. The old pool is located on the land that RRC wants to sell. The club didn't open the pool this summer. Instead, it struck a deal in which members could use the pool at nearby Northridge Country Club. RRC also would use some of the money to help pay down a loan from North State Bank that's in the neighborhood of $1.3 million. It's time to address it, says Blauen. He says that the club has about 400 members, including roughly 40 senior members, people who are over 70 years old and pay reduced dues. RRC lost around 100 members back in 2007 and 2008 due to a one-time assessment and increases in dues, but the overall membership number has remained relatively stable for the past couple of years. According to the nonprofit's 2008 tax return, the latest available, RRC posted 2008 revenue of $1.08 million, down from $1.49 million the previous year. Expenses clocked in at nearly $1.15 million. The club's revenue less expenses was a loss of $64,608 in 2008. Blauen asserts that the club now is back in the black operationally, but he declined to provide specific financial details. And with our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. First Citizens, BB&T, Wachovia, hit by alleged $45 million fraud scheme. A federal grand jury has returned an 11-count indictment against Paul Dewey, Lawing Jr., for defrauding several banks of $45 million. The 50-year-old Fayetteville resident is accused of 3 counts of bank fraud, 5 counts of wire fraud, and 3 counts of money laundering. He faces prison sentences that could total 220 years and fines that could total $5 million. The indictment alleges that between February 2001 and December 2005, Lawing, an energy broker and owner and president of National Gas Distributors, borrowed short-term capital from BB&T, First Citizens Bank and Trust Company, and Wachovia, and also took out commercial loans from private investment group Chatham Capital LLC. Federal prosecutors allege that between January 2005 and January 2006, Lawing engaged in a scheme to defraud those investors by falsely overstating National Gas Distributors' accounts receivables and prepaid gas supplies. UNC lands big money to test tiny tech. UNC cancer researchers have won a $13.6 million grant to work to use nanotechnology to improve the diagnosis and treatment of cancer. The 5-year grant from the National Cancer Institute is directed to UNC Chapel Hill's Carolina Center of Cancer Nanotechnology Excellence at the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. The work will be led by Joel Tepper and Joseph DeSimone. DeSimone is well known for his work in nanotechnology and has spun some of his past research into pharmaceutical startup company Liquidia Technologies, which is collaborating on the project. Heels Pack fans could win free Hardee's biscuits. Hardee's restaurants will give away coupons for free sausage biscuits to fans at UNC Chapel Hill and NC State home football game Saturday, but there is a catch to the deal. Well, actually, it's a kick. The giveaway is part of a halftime promotion in which a fan at each stadium has to kick a 30-yard field goal. Make the field goal, and everybody gets a biscuit. Miss, and everybody will just have to be happy with tailgating leftovers. Triangle to test new Brugger's Bagels store design menu. Brugger's Bagels is using its 20 locations in the Raleigh-Durham region to test a new store design concept that the bakery chain will be rolling out nationwide. Brugger's is investing $1 million in its Triangle locations by adding fresh decor, chairs, tables in all locations. The company also will test a new menu here. And finally, new retailer hits Triangle. Discount retailer Five Below is making its North Carolina debut with the opening of 4 Triangle stores located at shopping centers in Raleigh, Durham, Cary, and Apex. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.